Now, I know this is a big leap. I know it is. But when you've got something that is toxic, just plain poison, toxic, poison to the people who dig it or blast it, poison to the people who live around where it's being dug or blasted, poison to the water, poison to the air, poison when it's ground up, poison when it's so-called washed, poison when it's burnt, and poison when it's reduced to ash, and the whole damn thing is almost nothing but pure carbon. A statement like, looking at it is, what does it take for us to do to make coal a part of a low-carbon future? The answer to people using their big primate brains would seem to be, stop using it. If you want a low-carbon future, you kind of have to take the carbon out of the future. But no, no, there's this constant drumbeat of the possibility that science will be leveraged to give us this sort of frisbees and wheat checks kind of future where we can burn all the coal we want to, and we can blast all the mountains we want to, and we can poison all the communities we want to, because science is going to give us some gimcrack out of a gumball machine that's going to make coal low carbon. I mean, isn't that like low-fat butter? Isn't that like low-beef beef? Low-pork pork? How can you say that you want to have a low-carbon future, but you still want to be using the nastiest, filthiest, most vile source of carbon on the planet? Or perhaps perhaps you're clueless. Maybe, just maybe, you live in some sort of a bubble. And you don't know about dying hillbillies. And you don't know about people in China who can't breathe. Oh, we're going to come up with a science-based solution that's going to take all the carbon out of the carbon. Oh, God. And the reason Moniz said these things was because something my senator, a man not gifted with apparently a big primate brain, but rather one of those scary little lizard brains, big, well, no, not little, big amygdala, big amygdala, Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin responded to President Obama's not at all particularly inspiring, no matter what the Greens, big Greens, say, speech last week by saying, once again, that President Obama had declared a war on coal. Sweet Jesus. War on coal. But there are some smart folks, and they're cited in this article by Lauren McCauley over at Common Dreams. Energy chief confirms critics' fears Obama still loves coal. Secretary Ernest Moniz continues to tout myth of clean coal as foremost in energy strategy. Another in our series of seemingly endless series of people writing professional, allegedly professional journalism on the internet without the benefit of an editor. We'll get to that, though, because Lauren McCauley does cite some really smart folks. Over at Friends of the Earth, Damon Moglen, who is Climate and Energy Program Director, said a sensible climate plan would include a renunciation of the president's all-of-the-above energy strategy, which promotes biofuels, so-called clean coal, natural gas, and dirty and dangerous nuclear power. Well, I can get along with that. Makes sense to me, right? All right, so we got that. Damon Modlin continued, in order to address climate change, the president needs to focus on the ambitious development of renewable energy, energy storage, and efficiency technologies, while setting us on a path which clearly leaves behind the fossil fuel-based energy economy of the 20th century. Absolutely. Note to my friends at Friends of the Earth. You are still framing the issue much too esoterically. People are dying. Let's see if we can work with this quote here. A sensible human rights plan would include a renunciation of the president's all-of-the-above energy strategy. Because, see, what we're talking about here is a human rights issue. Because continued human survival is probably the most basic of all the human rights. Because rights of assembly or petition for redress of grievances or anything else along those lines really become rather inconsequential if there's no human to have them. And while the physicists can have their angels dancing on the head of a pin arguments about whether, you know, the rate at which the universe is expanding, how long the universe has to live, etc., 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 a reminder for us and for them, the universe ends hundreds of thousands of times per day on individual bases. It ended, what, 17, 19 times in Arizona over the weekend? For 19 austerity-strapped firefighters, the universe ended. The fact that you are still experiencing the universe doesn't mean it didn't end for them, because it did. The universe as they understood it ended. The universe as Texas Betsy, who now describes herself in the chat room as Hot and Sweaty Betsy, the universe ended for some youngins in the recent past. Lord God, I don't have the story right here in front of me, but trust me, the universe ended. And it ended through the agency, of course, of those freedom protecting firearms. Over at DSmog blog, Sharon Kelly wrote, the plan in rough form, talking about the Obama fascination of low carbon carbon. Oh, God, that just breaks me up every time I think of it. Low water, water. Low air, air. Low carbon, carbon. Low soil, dirt. Low bacon, bacon. Yeah. Sharon Kelly says, the plan in rough form involves collecting carbon dioxide emitted by power plants and burying it forever underground. If that sounds like a heck of a challenge, that's because it is. In fact, some people would say it's such a heck of a challenge that it approaches something that other scientists like to refer to as impossible. But once again, treating the issue as if it is not all wrapped up in human existence. See, one of the things that would be, I mean, you want to talk about a winner? Try this on for size. Instead of talking about coal as some sort of parlor game in which at some point someone develops a carbon capture and storage system and gets to yell, Jenga! Why don't we understand it as something that affects the ability of mothers to become grandmothers, of children to become adults? Because, see, that's what it is, at least here where I live and where my friends and my neighbors and my colleagues live. Over the weekend, I was down in the Coal River Valley where my friend and colleague and AIC campaign co-founder Bo Webb was hosting a memorial get-together for his recently passed on wife, Joanne, who, living just not too far at all beneath a mountaintop removal site, found out on December 3rd she had cancer, and on March the 3rd, passed on from this mortal coil. And I was reminded that our struggle has nothing to do with whether or not coal is clean. Because, see, let's assume for a moment that the really smart coal scientists come up with that carbon capture and storage plan. That means after they burn it, they can capture the carbon and it won't go into the atmosphere. It'll just, I don't know, sit on the back of a big truck underground somewhere and never bother anybody again. Unless it gets loose, in which case it'll just kill a whole lot of people. But let's assume that they can do that. Well, that means that they blow up even more mountains here. Hey, damn! Coal's clean now! Fire in the hole, baby! Right? Yeah. Which means that more people here get poisoned. More people here get to go to the doctor where the doctor says, this doesn't look good. And a doctor never says that, and it sounds good hearing it. No. Thank you, Sergi. I think I just got quoted on Sergi's Facebook page. To get a low-carbon future, you kind of have to take the carbon out of the future. I don't see any other way. I mean, there's only so many graphite golf club shafts that the world needs, right? So, an early nomination for Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz for continuing to trot out that tired, worn-out, clean coal future. That probably more, you know, Barack Obama came into his presidency thinking that, well, you know, I don't feel so good about gay marriage. I mean, let's give them a civil union or something. Let's give them something that's separate but equal. And a lot of people put a lot of pressure on him. And lo and behold, he is now firmly behind real marriage for real gay people. Now, this doesn't, of course, mean that gays get to just bust down the walls of their local Catholic church and pedophilia center and demand that the priest marry him up right there in the altar in front of Jeebus and everybody. Can't do that. First Amendment says you can't do that. But it does mean that they can get married as they see fit, because marriage is created by the state, not the church, and hopefully live happily ever after, although probably what they'll live is ordinarily after ever after, because that's generally what happens with marriages. You settle into a routine. Try to spice it up now and then, and that's not even being sexual. You go to a different place for dinner, you know, you get a new set of drapes, or change the tablecloth, you know, but mostly there's a routine. Welcome to it. Barack Obama evolved on the issue of marriage equality. But by God, he has not evolved one damn dime's worth on the issue of human rights in Appalachia, where in West Virginia's mountaintop removal communities, the universe ends involuntarily for 4,000 people per year. Yeah, sure. Science calls them, and statisticians call them, excess deaths. Sounds rather clinical, doesn't it? Until one of those excess deaths turns out to be your mother, or your father, or your child, or your cousin, or your aunt, or your uncle, or your husband, or your wife. And Barack Obama has not evolved worth a good goddamn on us hillbillies' ability to go on being hillbillies. And I say hillbillies because, remember, after all, when you let this sort of thing happen to people, we really don't get to call ourselves humans, let alone Americans. Just saying. And with that, a little note from, and by the way, thank you, Sal. Thank you very kindly. That takes us down to, goodness me. We are now down to $65 to raise for this evening. Thank you, Sal. Our buddy Billy, who is over in Maryland, and he is in the congressional district of a representative by the name of Chris Van Hollen, who, for reasons known but to him and him, has not yet signed on to the AIC Act, H.R. 526. We'd like for him to. He's rather a powerful member of the Democratic Party in the House of Representatives. It would be a big deal if he signed on. So Billy writes in from Maryland and says, "Hey, Bob, I have a different type of challenge for you to propose to our Horn family members, one to increase the urgency of the AIC Act co-sponsorship. As you and some listeners may know, I live in a heavily liberal district represented by Chris Van Hollen, and he has a strong background as a progressive sympathetic to the environment. However, he has not yet co-sponsored the AIC Act. So my unique and different contribution challenge is this. Once five people have called in to Chris Van Hollen's office to request he sponsor the AIC Act, hey, if more than five people call in to Chris Van Hollen's office, I will add an additional $5 to each campaign. If you could please announce Van Hollen's office phone number over the air tonight, it is area code 202-225-5341. Area code 202-225-5341. And Billy says, I'd request that people who take part in this challenge email you, and Billy says me too, but I generally don't give out other people's email addresses on the air. So here's what I'll do. You email me, and I'll forward the email to Billy. And let us know, Billy says, that they called in so we can learn their reaction. That way, we both know how many people called in, and we can hold each other accountable, because I tend to be forgetful sometimes. Oh, okay. Well, I still don't want to give out an email. Let's say, Billy says, this challenge is ongoing, but we need to have the five callers in by next Friday, the 5th of July, so I can donate the $25 both to the 8th campaign and $25 to the Horn. Let's make that Wednesday, Billy, because nothing is going to happen on Thursday or Friday, being that Thursday and Friday are the 4th and 5th of July. Billy says he's been reading Deer Hunting with Jesus lately. Joe Bajant's magnificent work. So he spent the weekend at a wedding, which is cool, down in Charleston. He says, I hope this challenge isn't too complicated. If it is, let me know. I'll try to simplify the text. No, it's not too complicated at all. Chris Van Hollen's office is area code 202-225-5341. If you live in his district, that makes it especially relevant. But you know what? If you don't, that's okay too. So 202-225-5341, maybe in the morning. And then shoot me a note and I will forward it to Billy. What a cool way to do two things at once, huh? So thanks in advance, and thanks to Billy for coming up with that really creative way of getting folks involved. Ernest Moniz becomes an early nominee for this Moran Monday. But mercy, mercy. We have more than enough to keep us busy for the rest of the night. Just because, and I keep alluding to this, while we're still on alleged Democrats, emphasis on the word alleged, I gotta bring this to your attention. I mentioned it briefly last week, but, this deserves a Moran Monday spotlight. Our Moran in question is allegedly Democratic Governor Earl Ray Tomblin of my state, West Virginia Stan. We've had a little budget shortfall in these parts. Over the last year or so, coal production has declined in this state. And coal, by the way, has something, and it hasn't been around that long, really, relatively speaking. Coal extracted in this state has something called a severance tax imposed upon it. A whole nickel a ton. Yeah, really, a whole nickel. Don't despair. You'd like to have a nose like Mr. Fields is all full of nickels, wouldn't you? Sure you would. Yeah, let's see. Just for the fun of it. The current coal price per ton is, just so we can get an idea of what we're talking about. No, that's behind the paywall, bastards. Try him again here. Trust me, it's not 10 cents a ton. There we go. Coal prices per ton were down $3.61 on the world market today. Down 3.61%. It's expressed as a function as a percentage, not per dollar. coal, thermal coal, the kind you burn in coal-fired power plants to poison communities, kill little asthmatic children, goes for $53.72 per short ton. Metallurgical coal goes for a whole lot more. So out of every ton of coal that comes out of West Virginia, presently valued at $53.72 per short ton, West Virginia gets a whole nickel. Isn't that great? God, you've only got to sell 20 tons to come up with a dollar. Ooh-wee. Any idea how much blasting has to take place in order to not be here? How many microns of polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons you have to breathe, but now me neither. But anyway, there's been a shortfall, you know, because of that Obama war on coal, right? There's been a shortfall in revenues because of the coal severance tax. Can you imagine what it takes to run an entire state budget on coal severance taxes when the severance taxes, oh, I forgot to tell you something, out of that nickel a ton, we rebate 3 cents back to the coal industry every time. So you pay a nickel and you get 3 cents back. It's like something out of Milo Minder Binder's M&M Enterprises out of Catch-22. You buy eggs in Malta for 3 cents and you sell them in Beirut for... No, you buy them for five and you sell them for three and everybody makes a profit. So there's been a shortfall in coal production in West Virginia, and so consequently there is a budget shortfall, and yeah, so we've got some making up to do. Now, if you and I were governor of the state, you or I were governor of the state of West Virginia, and we received a report saying, Your Excellency, Mr. or Ms. Governor, we've got a budget shortfall. We don't have enough money to pay the state's bills. And we've got to balance that budget. You or I as governor, and mostly that shortfall is because of declining production on coal in this state. Maybe one of the first things we think is, 5 cents and we rebate 3 cents. Okay, let's kill the rebate. And what do you say, since coal's trading at $53.72 a short ton, we run that up to $1 a ton. Get me my special proclamation paper and my proclamation writing pen out. I'm a calling a special session of the legislature, and we ain't gonna... No, it doesn't work that way here. No, instead, Moran Monday nominee, alleged Democrat Governor Earl Ray Tomlin, you know, anytime you shake hands with him, you wind up feeling like you need to go take a shower and effing bleach. Now, Governor Earl Ray came up with a better solution. Hi! I know where there's some money. What we need to do is go over to the Medicaid box. I was looking in it the other day, and there's just a pot full of money in it. I don't know how we missed it. It's supposed to be there to provide insurance for poor folks, but somehow or another we come up with a bunch of rules keeps the poor folks from being able to access the Medicaid. And it's got a lot of money in it. And we're going to get a whole bunch more next year because of that one's Obamacare. And the Medicaid expansion that I signed off on, which now we understand why I did. Robbing Peter to pay Paul? What you talking about? We're going to go slit Peter's throat and pay Paul. It really. Governor Earl Ray signed an executive order this past Friday that tapped into the reserve funds for Medicaid, you know, that helps take care of old folks, and poor folks, and little folks. I don't mean leprechauns by that. To make up the budget shortfall in this state. Because this state just doesn't take a big steam and crap on poor folks quite enough. I mean, we make them breathe poison every day of their lives. We let the coal companies poison their water and poison their air and poison the soil where maybe they'd like to just, you know, raise a tomato in the summer. But that ain't enough. We gotta take that extra money out. Because the coal industry's having a hard time coming up with their nickel a ton. You'll pardon me. You'll pardon me, I hope. If this doesn't strike me as something even remotely resembling humane, or God knows, even in the same county with intelligent. Earl Ray claims to be a Christian. It ain't Christian. Ron and Raleigh writing in, "I've got an idea," says Ron. "We could make coal a part of our clean energy future if we could burn it on the moon. Then all we'd need to do is find a way to mine it cleanly." I went dark at 8:21 of the program? What'd I miss, says Ron. Oh, just more conniption. Man, oh man, Ron continues. Coal industry could go broke paying out that kind of coal hard cash. Get it? Coal hard cash? He'll be here all week. Try the video. Speaking of all week, by the way, a program note. No show on Thursday. It's the 4th of July. Taking a little time off. Maybe I'll be dangling my feet in some water somewhere and burning my little pink hide a little bit. No, I'll be dipped by the heel in the SPF Avogadro's number. Thank you, David, angry architect, who just took care of fundraising for tonight. Finished it off. Had 65 to go, and David zeroed that out. Thank you very kindly. 42 minutes into the program. That's pretty darn good in my book. But it is. It's Moran Monday on the horn. And, well, I want to go back. I've been sitting on this story for nearly 2 weeks. And I am not going to let a choice little morsel like this go by without sharing it. And since we were, in fact, talking about crapping on poor people, this fits. Now, we've grandfathered Godzilla from Wasilla and 1L Michelle and a few other folks out of Moran Monday because, well, there wouldn't be any competition if we didn't. But we have not grandfathered out Loopy Louie Gomer. Louie is deeply offended. I mean, it's been tough for Louie. At first, you got the Attorney General of the United States casting aspersions on his asparagus. We remember that, don't we? Please don't make me play that again. He really said it. Are you casting aspersions on my asparagus? Louie is apparently a foodie. because, well, he can't quit talking about it. So it was back along the middle, around the third week of June, when, after the Repiglickans got called out for the way they approached the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, otherwise fondly or vilifyingly referred to as food stamps, after they got called out for the merciless pricks that they are for trying to cut poor folks' access to food, well, Louis was offended that anybody would think that a upstanding, God-fearing follower of Christ like his Seth could possibly ever be so mean and so heartless and so hateful and so vicious and so vile and, in fact, evil for him as a Republican to want to take food out of hungry children's mouths. And he took to the floor of the House of Representatives to make sure you all understood how he felt about it. So you'll quit calling him mean, because it's just Christian what he's doing. Right?
When I look into the eyes of constituents who want to provide for their children, they want them to have the best that they can provide for them.
Oh, wait a minute, Louis. He looks into the eyes of his constituents who want to have the best for their children. How about your constituents, Louis, and other American citizens, all of whom combine to write your paycheck, which you seem to have no compunction against cashing on a monthly basis, or probably biweekly, maybe weekly, who knows? They want the best for their children. But, Louis, how about those who have sent the best packing, who instead are happy if they can just send their children to bed without hearing their guts rumble? How about those for whom the best is aspirational only, as we say of democracy? How about those folks, Louis?
And they talk about standing in line. I've heard this story so many times from people who are brokenhearted about it. And
by "I've heard this story so many times," he means, since he's a Christian and therefore a liar, what he means is that he has fantasized this, about this inside his skull through the good offices of that big old lizard brain of his. That's what he means by "I heard this so many times."
Sometimes get angry just thinking about what they've seen and what they've heard.
My God, what is he on about? I mean, he's thought about what they've told him, and he gets angry just thinking about what they've seen and what they've heard. I mean, you'd think, I mean, what could possibly get you so angry? Because I know what makes me angry like that. Photographs of human beings who don't have access to clean drinking water or enough food to eat, or maybe who are having their homes blown into tiny molecular particles by, well, I don't know, Hellfire missiles or Tomahawk cruise missiles. Remember when Donald Rumsfeld said Afghanistan wasn't any fun because there wasn't any good shit left to blow up anymore? Yeah, seeing a man carrying the body of his limp, lifeless, dead daughter out of a pile of rubble, yeah, that gets me angry. What gets you angry, Louie?
But standing in line at a grocery store behind people with a food stamp card, and they look...
You just knew, didn't you? So, he's got constituents who get furious standing in line. You know, we probably need a separate grocery store line for people with food stamp cards. you know, with that extra dose of shame and the meanest cashier the store has and somebody will look down their noses. And, right.
In their basket, as one individual said, I love crab legs.
Language moment. In their basket, as one individual said, I love crab legs. Anybody want to diagram that real quick? Probably not.
King, you know, the big king crab legs. I love those. But we hadn't been able to have them in our house, and who knows when. But I'm standing behind a guy.
Buster, that's because you go out to the Peking buffet on Friday night for Crab Leg Friday and have and have those people do the work for you, right? Shh. Louis's got a lot of Christian constituents, and they lie to him, and then he lies to us. You understand how it works.
He has those in his basket, and I'm looking longingly, like, when can I ever make enough again? Well,
longingly. He looks longingly at them, like the little match girl, with her little face pressed up against the frosty window pane, looking in at the food stamp people eating all that yummy food that they ain't been able to eat in forever. Texas Betsy with a question: how on earth does the customer know how the customer in front of them are paying for their groceries? Well, they're nosy like that, Betsy. Because usually the SNAP card doesn't look like anybody else's card. It'll say something like Lone Star Lowlifes or something like that on it, if you're in Texas. Or maybe here in West Virginia, it's a plastic card that says, EBT card that says Hillbilly Handout. That's how. And these conservatives, they watch real careful in the grocery line. They apply a little Christian discipline to their youngin'. Be quiet here. We're trying to figure out how that moocher in front of us is paying for them crab legs. We're gonna knock them over in the parking lot and take them is what we're going to do. Betsy says, here, it looks just like a Visa, but it does indeed say Lone Star. And how did you know that? Well, what else would you call it in Texas? Rick Perry Moocher card? Lone Star. Yeah, I'm psychotic that way. Kidneys, man, kidneys.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Lone Star loser card. But back to Louis, speaking of losers.
Where our family can have something like that and then sees the food stamp card pulled out and provided.
See, they're watching. They're paying attention because, see, that's what you got to do in America, or them moochers will eat up all our freedom. And they'll dip our freedom in butter. And they'll leave the smelly crab leg shells outside our house for us to clean up after them because they're that way.
He looks at the king crab legs and looks at his ground meat and realizes because he...
Keep it in your pants, Buster. Nobody wants you looking at... Never mind, I think I misunderstood that. But I can be forgiven. I don't know how you ground that. I mean, the copper wire that goes down your pants leg to the rubber sole of your shoes? Like what?
He does pay income tax. He doesn't get more back than he pays in.
Oh, doesn't he? Now, isn't he living in Texas? Doesn't Texas get back $2 for every buck that Texas pays in? We're going to have to add Lion Louie to your various and sundry nickname there, Lou.
He is actually helping pay for the king crab legs when he can't pay for them for himself?
He could pay for them for himself. He's got income, right? Maybe he'd like to have the cable turned off and save all that money from all them cable Jesus channels that come on down there. And then he could have him some crab legs. Welcome to the market, Louie. Welcome to the market. Maybe he could mow his own grass instead of paying Jesus to mow it for him.
And people across the aisle want to condemn anyone who is working and scraping and can't save any money and is trying to decide how in the world do we ever get ahead? Can we ever get ahead?
Or can we even, never mind ahead, we just want the king crab legs. No, nobody was saying that, Louie. Yeah, you're trying to beat the tar out of that straw, man, but, buddy, you're swinging and missing. Is that a wiffle bat you got in your hands?
You know, they're cutting back my hours at work. We're doing the best we can.
Of course, you live in a state where regulation is communism, and if they're cutting back hours at work, well, that's just the market, ain't it?
And yet I stand in line and see multiple people paying with food stamp card.
Oh, now it's multiple people. Now there's three or four people out in front of our heroic servant of the free market who's standing there staring at his ground meat. There's a whole line full of. It must have been food stamp Alaskan King crab legs commodity night. Multiple people. It would almost be worth playing the lottery to go and put my dollar in and win a couple or $10 million and just start buying ads in the first district of Texas that show the asparagus quote and the multiple people buying king crab legs quote and just asking the question, do you really vote for this guy? Or do you just play a little Pac-Man on the video game voting machine and hope for the best?
Want to condemn anyone who is working and scraping?
No, nobody condemned anybody who's working and scraping, Louie. We're condemning you because you're an asshat. Because you begrudge food to people. Shh, by the way, the average monthly SNAP benefit for a single person is $133.44. You can get a package of frozen, frost-burned king crab legs for about $25. Maybe less if you're just willing to go for, you know, a littler hunk. So after these multiple people are up there buying their king crab legs, taunting that hard-working servant of the free market back there, staring at his ground meat, then you'll have about $102 to get through the other 29 to 30 days with. Won't get you very far. Gonna be a whole lot of ramen for that one night of licentious crab leg eating. That one moment of joy that you had sticking it to that feller who's a forlornly staring at his ground meat.
And can't save any money and is trying to decide how in the world do we ever get a head, can we ever...
Maybe he can't save any money because all of his savings were stolen by Louis' buddies over at Enron back at the beginning of the aughts. Couldn't be. He's got a highly Christian constituency. Why isn't Jesus passing out the king crab legs there to the multi-mega worship center? Maybe because they're not kosher. But let's leave Jesus' ethnicity out of that because they really don't like to think about it.
Get ahead. You know, they're cutting back my hours at work. We're doing the best we can. And yet I stand in line and see multiple people paying with food stamp cards for things I cannot afford. How can you begrudge somebody who feels that way?
In other words, how can you begrudge someone who begrudges someone else food? It's actually pretty easy, Louis. It's not even begrudgery. It's an observation that you have just put on display a pretty ugly little fascist streak in which you are strongly invested.
How can you begrudge anyone who steps up on behalf of constituents who feel that way? We don't.
Okay, so it's really about him. Look, Louis, get off the cross. We need the wood.
I don't want anyone to go hungry.
You just don't want them eating crab legs. Okay, so, all right, we're going to go and we're going to put the crab legs back. How you feel about ribeye steaks? Nope, can't have those either. Okay, put the ribeye back. Can I have some of that ground meat your boy's staring back at there? How dare you! Fiends, go get the damn Vienna sausages and be happy you've got them courtesy of the good God, fair, and people of America, or we'll take away the saltines.
And from the amount of obesity in this country...
Oh, wait a minute. Not only are people on SNAP, not only are they profligate eaters of crab legs, they're also fat. They're fat crab leg eaters. Dipping them in that luscious butter. I haven't had butter, and I don't know when. We've been using that shed spread. Or that I'm pretty sure it ain't butter stuff that comes in a tub. And we do it because we're Americans and we love Jesus.
By people we're told do not have enough to eat, it does seem like we could have a debate about this issue without allegations about wanting to slap down or starve children.
We can, Louis. We really can. But you have to stop wanting to slap down or starve children before we can. Until then, it's going to be about your willingness to cut access to food for little ones. This is such a rotten old meme. This is such a filthy, worn-out trope. It goes all the way back to that greasy-headed B-movie actor and his invention of the Welfare Queen. I'm trying to think. It was sometime after I left the radio station over there in America's fifth smallest radio market that they quit carrying Flush Flimball because he was costing them too much money. And they decided to pick up this creep out of Atlanta called Neil Bortz. What really is his name? Bortz. B-O-O-R-T-Z. Bortz. And so that would mean it would be at least 2005. 8 years ago to the day, yesterday, was my, as Horst pointed out, on the Facebook page. By the way, friend up on Facebook with me. Comment on the page. Let's have a rollicking little discussion, and we already are. It just goes 24/7 wherever you are. Bob Kincaid is what it is on Facebook. On Twitter, it's at Bob Kincaid. And we'll just keep the conversation going pretty much 24/7. But yeah, Horst pointed out on the Facebook page that it was 8 years ago yesterday that I got the boot from America's fifth smallest radio market for talking mean about the coal industry. So it was something a little less than 8 years ago, maybe seven, that I happened to be toddling around in the car one day, and yes, I listen to talk radio some. I can't stand classic country or classic rock or, I don't know, classic Pazookie channels. No. Just can't. The only classic country I'll ever listen to is if I'm anywhere near the reception distance of WSM Nashville. That is classic country. So I usually, if there's nothing going on National Petroleum Radio, I default to the local talk radio and just listen to the idiots screaming in the monkey house. And it was somewhere around 7 years ago that I heard Neil Bortz bemoaning someone standing in line in front of him buying food of which he did not approve with a food stamp benefits card. 7 years. 7 years ago, I thought, man, this is one nasty little right-wing pissant. Of course, he's a libertarian. And 7 years later, I get it again. Because it's never gone away. Remember, these are Republicans, the people who hate big government. But somehow or another, the people who hate big government want government out there telling folks what they can and cannot buy with their retail-based food stamp cards. I can remember when commodities were how excess food was delivered. Might be worthwhile to remind folks that that was developed as a means of dealing with surplus production by America's farming sector, which was then purchased by the government and in many cases given to the needy, folks who would go hungry without it. It was rice, it was beans, it was flour, peanut butter, the awesomest cheese you ever ate in your life, made the meanest pan of macaroni and cheese you will ever know. I know this because out there at the plant, at the furnace, fellas would swap it. You know, give you a brick of cheese for a pack of cigarettes. Yeah. No, really. Or if they liked you, they'd just say, "Well, I heard you like that commodity cheese. I know you can't have none, so I brung you some." That's how it often happened with my dad. And then mother would make some macaroni and cheese, and next day in his lunch bucket, he'd take several portions of macaroni and cheese wrapped up, and you know, in between stoking and tapping the furnace, when lunchtime came around, they'd all sit down over some macaroni and cheese. Mercy was good, especially when you made the mac and cheese and then you baked it. It got that golden brown thing going across the top.
Oh!
But that was how it started. But then some Republican came along and said, "Wait a minute, ain't enough hogs got their front feet in the troughs? America's grocery retailers need us to support business." And so food stamps came. And they were sort of printed like Monopoly money. I mean, they looked like Monopoly money. They came in weird-ass colors in a book. And after a while, the Republicans didn't like that either, because sometimes you could get a little cash money in change if you had less than, and then there was folks out there swapping them for, you know, a bag of that there dope, because it had a cash value. So along come the electronic benefits card, which again are a great big damn giveaway to the giant multinational banking sector, because somebody has to administer them. And that's a trend that's gathering more and more steam. For instance, in the Old Dominion, Virginia, they looked to... Oh, God, what's the name of the company? They looked to Comerica to issue the Virginia Tax Refund Way to Go MasterCard. Now, Comerica promised the Old Dominion that there would be no fees imposed upon the state for folks using their tax refund cards. No fees. Except for the fact that there's tons of fees on people who want to use them. You can use it, let's see, and this was through Xerox, by the way. Xerox set up the system and then subcontracted to Comerica, who issued the cards. One free online transfer was promised, but if you tried to do the online transfer, well, turns out there was a $2 fee attached. Then you got two free calls to find out what your balance was per month, but if you made a third call, there was a $2 fee attached to that. What a con. This is wealth transfer, right? The food stamp program was wealth transfer indirectly, because instead of letting farmers' crops and produce just go to waste, the government transferred wealth to the farmers and got the excess produce in return and gave it away for free to poor people. But then the idea of retail, as noted, entered into it. And we did another wealth transfer. Instead of buying at wholesale, people who needed food but had no way to provide it to their families were required to go into grocery stores where they had, admittedly, a wider choice, but were also paying retail prices, in other words, the grocery store's markup. And then along comes this latest dodge, the electronic transfer card, where if you happen to have $133 a month on the card, you get a limited number of calls to find out what your balance is. And some portion of the funds that, I mean, it doesn't come out of your $133, but some portion of the food stamp funds go to support the mega bank infrastructure that manages the funds for the government. Because, you know, government can't do that by themselves in Congress. Jesus. Steve writes in, subject line, crab legs. I live in a neighborhood where lots of folks have their SNAP card. Guess what? Ain't nobody on welfare buying crab legs. When do bastards like Gohmert Pyle get pissed off at Wall Street paying out billions of bonuses with our money? Hint, never. Steve merely closes by saying, what a lie. Michael writing, begrudge not, lest ye be begrudged. Jesus, in line, buying crab legs. And Marty noting, actually, the food stamps look more like old Disneyland tickets. Ever having been to Disneyland? I would not know. Marty also pointing out that since Louis Gohmert is from Texas, he must be referring to some great special on seafood at the local H-E-B. H-E-B? Now, I hate it when you go all over my head with the language. A longer note from Steve. A little look at how hard and how badly life can get here in the greatest country in the world. He says, I heard when you read my email on the air last week. Odd as it may sound, I listened to it several times. I still can't help but feel ashamed. Maybe a better word is embarrassed at my situation. I'm much more fortunate than an awful lot out there. I know I am. In that regard, I'm still not sure why I'm getting all this off my chest to you and the Horn family, other than, well, you're the Horn family. Still plugging away out here. I'm going to be able to do some work for a friend of mine to pay the July rent. Got to pay the $530 Cobra. Had to ask Dad for help there. I've had several nibbles out here in the job market. A couple of the jobs are working for a large bank or a large law firm doing foreclosure work. Bob, I feel I should beg your and the Horn family's forgiveness if I were to have to take one of those jobs. This is so not me. Why does there seem to be no money in doing justice? Why does there seem to be no money in doing the right thing? I have so many bills to pay between the student loans, and yes, I will eventually pay off those defaulted loans I previously talked about to helping out family and friends, and I have already committed in my own mind, if I do get one of these lucrative jobs, I'll be giving to the Horn family. Man, Steve, worry about what you've got to worry about first. Steve continues, you know, there were several things I didn't tell you in the first email I sent. Bills I became behind on I couldn't afford. Hell, I have tax debts I just couldn't afford for a couple of years because I was, again, supporting family. Finally, I got the big tax bill. And you know what? The percentage the feds want me to pay is on the order of 40%. Again, I won't kid you. I know I did wrong. I know I should have set money aside for that. I intended to, but just didn't make enough to do that and help family. As much as I know I'm to blame for that, when I saw that bill, I couldn't stop thinking of Bishop Willard and his less than 15% effective tax rate. I couldn't help but think of these scams to just push money offshore to Bermuda or some other foreign place in order not to earn it in the U.S. And presto, change-o, lower or no income. Again, I know I was wrong. Steve, I'd stop beating myself up if I were you. I really would. Steve says, again, I know I was wrong, but what could I do? Was I supposed to put this government ahead of supporting my family? I hope I don't sound like some libertarian complaining about my too high taxes. I'm not. However, taxes are too high on middle class and poor folks. And don't let anyone say for a moment poor folks don't pay taxes. Who do you think pays those sales taxes, use fees, and so on? Middle class and poor folks do. And you know what? It takes away more of our income than the one percenters. The flip side of that, taxes are too low, no, way too low on the 1%. They clamor about paying 80-plus percent of the taxes. Guess what? They own 95% of everything. They make 90% of the income in this country. They get nearly 100% of the benefits of the commons in society. Here I go rambling again. Again, I'm sorry to you and the Horn family. Quit apologizing, Steve. I didn't pay my taxes when I should have, but really I couldn't afford it, just like the student loans. But as I asked before and I will ask now, why are we the ones to be responsible? Why do we have to live our entire lives with our mistakes? All I can do is ask for forgiveness from you and the Horn family. You have nothing to ask forgiveness from anyone for. You're not even in the same ballpark with sin, Steve. He says, I didn't do what I should have and intended to do. I just was not going to choose financing the government, its requisite wars and tax cuts for those who didn't need them, over helping my family survive. But I will make this commitment to you and the Horn family. I'll make right where I've done wrong. When I'm on my feet, able to send in the money to the Horn, I'll do it. That'll be my penance. Hey, Steve, nobody wants to be your penance, my friend. And we are certainly not in the indulgence business. Hell, we're not in any business at all. If we were in business, we'd have been out of business about 7 years ago. Now, this is a community with emphasis on the word commune. This is a family. And I don't think there's anybody out there that have you beating yourself up, Steve. You can be all right, but the first part of being all right is being okay with you. So quit beating yourself up. We're here, and you're with us. And your faith. So, that's just the beginning of the filibuster. Well, I mean, that is the filibuster. It can be longer if you want it to. But one other moment from life with Louie before we cut away. Holy Jeebus. After the Supreme Court issued its ruling, such as it was, regarding Prop Hate and DOMA. Louis pushed himself back from the crab legs long enough to go and talk about, well, what that ruling meant. And if you thought he was upset about them poor people using them federal the taxpayers' dollars to buy them crab legs, well, you don't know pissed off.
Oyster, they were not aware that the most wise man in history, Solomon, said there's nothing new under the sun, and this isn't new, and it's been tried over and over, and it's usually tried at the end of a great civilization. So, just in closing...
What? We must have missed a word or something, because I heard something in there about the wisest man in the world. The wisest man the world has ever known, Solomon. Really? Was he wiser than Jeebus? I mean, I know Solomon gets a lot of good press, but really he was wiser than Lao Tzu, wiser than Confucius, wiser than the Buddha, wiser than Krishna, wiser than, well, we can have wars over this, wiser than Muhammad? Wiser than Sitting Bull? Wiser than George Washington? Wiser than Quetzalcoatl? The wisest man in the world.
apparently they've been very cloistered. They were not aware that the most wise man in history, Solomon.
Yeah, Marty adds, wiser than the oracle at Delphi? Yeah. That's a lot of wisdom.
Said there's nothing new under the sun, and this isn't new, and it's been tried over and over, and it's...
Wait. Marriage equality has been tried over and over? The stupid is strong with this one. Wait. The stupid is strong with this one. Much better.
Usually tried at the end of a great civilization. So, just in closing, I would remind you of the document that allowed the United States to claim its independence and be free as recognized by England.
Louis? You remember, some school in Texas gave this guy a law degree. That's funnier than some school in West Virginia giving me one. The Declaration of Independence was recognized by Great Britain. You got that? You understood that the same way as I? Good. So, July the 4th, 1776, and of course there's a little bit of dodginess back and forth, but July the 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence is proclaimed. And right quick, like, they put it on a boat and, return address T. Jefferson, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And it's addressed to King George III in England. And they put it on the best boat they got, and they get it over there. And King George opens it up, puts on his spectacles. Oh, there, what have we here? A Declaration of Independence. Saying some rather nasty things about me.
But they're all true. I recognize the Declaration of Independence. Cuts him loose.
And that whole little dust-up we had between... Yeah, that didn't happen.
Free as recognized by England... The Treaty of Paris, 1780.
Oh, the Treaty of Paris. It took a little
while. And if you will look at that document, you will see big, bold letters at the very top. Because put yourself in the place of the...
Big, bold letters at the top because put yourself in the place of the...
Americans. What?
Of the Americans, okay. Is that what it says at the top of the Treaty of Paris of 1783? Put yourself in the place of the Americans? I'll be damned.
What would you make Britain swear under that they would be so afraid to go back on their word? What would you make them swear under that document?
Crab legs?
That required England to recognize our independence.
Asparagus?
Well, what our founders came up with were these words, in the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity. That's why it started that way. And
except for the fact that there would be entire legions of people who, holy and undivided Trinity, but it's undivided, but it's three at the same, it's a really special kind of math that even the Newtons and Stephen Hawkings haven't figured out yet. No, what that was a finger in the eye of the religious dogmatists. But, let's not smarten up a chump.
That even the adversaries in war would have the nerve to go against that. What we now have today is a holy quintet who goes against the laws of nature and nature's God. And that's very unfortunate.
Is he arguing somehow that the Supreme Court violated the Treaty of Paris. I mean, bless his little lizard-brained head. He just doesn't make a whole ton, or even a short ton, of sense. Beats me. But apparently, there was something in the Treaty of Paris of 1783 that said gay folks can't get married? I'm lit. Oh, wiser, asks Marty, wiser than the Dalai Lama? That's Solomon. He was some kind of wise. Didn't know how or why the sun rose and set, or the fact that it doesn't really. Didn't understand that the sun doesn't revolve around the earth. Didn't really know why it rained. Learned to walk upright by pushing a wheelbarrow. But the wisest man the world has ever known. Oh, shut up, Louis. Shut up. Go and eat your asparagus. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. The number is 304-658-3333. Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. Jump right in. The conversation's fine. That seemed appropriate. We are a little over the halfway mark in tonight's Moran Monday here on the Horn. Of course, Bruce Springsteen, From the River, Hungry Heart, couldn't resist. Let's keep it all going, and we'll go straight to the phone. Well, we're not going straight. I got an email to read here. Just a reminder, Kevin asking, when you come back from break, can you turn the volume up a bit? I can hear you, but having to turn volume up on high to do so here. Thanks, Kevin. And I responded, but just a matter, a reminder. Some of this has to do with the fact that this equipment's dying. And I am pushing this signal for all it's worth. But the fact of the matter is, all these, things like mixed discs have preamps in them. And preamps get old and tired and eventually give up the ghost. And that's kind of where we are. As soon as I have a chance to tech for a little while with John Fox, maybe we'll try some other channels to see if they're maybe not worn out from not having been used as much as this one particular one has. But I don't know. This just came in from Cassie. Our Cassie. At college. Soon to be out of college. And then to be in law school. And the subject line is a letter for Steve. Dear Steve, the government is collecting your penance. The horn just wants your thoughts and ideas, and your experience, and your love. We're a family. We help each other out when we can and where we can. In 7 years, my total financial contributions to the horn are right around $20. But I call and write and laugh and cry and opine. The horn is my family. One of my families, anyway. Horn members helped me with college and scholarship essays. Bob and listeners in the chat room helped me with homework when I was in middle school. Actually, some of the listeners still do. Horn members have provided me with housing and real in-person parenting when I left an abusive family situation. Horn members sent graduation gifts when I finished high school, and Bob keeps threatening to come up to Princeton next June when I graduate from college. Horn members sent cookies and gloves to my dorm room my freshman year. Maura, wonderful Maura, offered to be my local auntie when I moved to New Jersey. Texas Betsy has been my horn mom for years, and Bob's been my horn dad. I cannot tell you how many of my internet aunties and uncles are horn listeners. Sometimes we give. Sometimes we take. Sometimes it's financial, and other times it's for other things. We are family. Bob is right. Stop apologizing and just take care of your debts and your family until you can contribute without it affecting your own food or rent for the month. We love you already. Just keep writing. Your sis, or cousin, or niece, or whatever. Cassie. She has a P.S. Once you start getting fan mail on the air, you know you're really a Horn family member. And you just got this. You just got this. So, to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Jim in Covington, Stan, Louisiana, Stan.
How you doing, Jim?
Oh, all right. Man, what a great beginning. I guess I'll just limit my comment to you're talking about, clean coal. It's like the ultimate in Orwellian doublespeak, you know, like war is peace, love is hate, ignorance is strength. I mean, they just...
Up is down, night is day.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible.
Whatever you think it is, it ain't. It's the opposite.
Yeah, it's just, and then you try talking to people, even so-called educated people, and they either choose to ignore it or think it'll go away or just think you're some sort of radical revolutionary or something like that.
And inside that, Jim, is the constantly shifting definition of what radical is. And we have now reached a point in the second decade of the 21st century where thinking of every American should have a square meal or three during any given day is radical communism.
Yeah.
I mean, doesn't that just beat the sneakers off your feet?
It does, and I like I say, I know people. In fact, I was at a little family shindig a couple of weeks ago, and there's a guy in his 70s, and I was listening to him talking, and he was going on about social security Security, and they should kind of basically implying that there should be limits on it. I'm thinking, now that you've got yours, everything's all right, but you want to make other people eat cat food or whatever, you know, cut their benefits or whatever. You know, it's just it's really selfish, self-centered.
Well, it would, you know what, I could almost tolerate it if they would just come out, if they'd quit hiding behind Jesus' robes when they do it.
Yeah.
Well, see, yeah, but see, Jesus fed them with loaves and fishes, not loaves and crab legs.
Yeah, that was a big fish, though. Finish. Yeah, it was a huge, it's like a whale. But, you know, and like, you know, they were just waxing poetically ignored. You know, it's like the lady about, you know, was quoted saying about, her benefits. Keep your hands off my Social Security.
Yeah. You know. Keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Yeah.
Teabag.
And then also, oh yeah. And then there was also an excellent point about the, you know, the universe ending for those 19 firefighters. And, you know, I mean, you could tie that into, that's global climate change to a great extent, you know.
Yeah, and it doesn't, and climate change doesn't have to be complete for it to end the universe.
Well, I mean, I don't know if I've talked to you about this, but I mean, it's just like the human body. That's like a universe unto itself. And like when your body gets a virus or something like that, what does your body do to fight it off? It raises a fever. I mean, your fever raises the temperature to, you know, kill off whatever bacteria, whatever's causing the fever. Yeah, a 1% change in your temperature, you got a fever of 100. But like a 5% change, you got 104, 105 fever. That'll be very uncomfortable, very, you know.
It gets life threatening.
Yeah.
And you know, that teaches us a lesson, Jim, about the very narrow band in which human beings can exist. We can't stand, you know, a reptile, and remember those pigliacans frequently have lizard brains. A reptile has no means of cooling its system at all.
Right.
It is the same temperature as the air around it. So when it gets really cold, a bit of torpor sets in. And when it gets warm, they get kind of frisky. Which is rough when you're, you know, if you're around an alligator that's feeling frisky. The same thing happens inside the human body. Except for the fact that we regulate temperature, but we can only regulate it within a very, very narrow band. We've got the big brains that allow us to develop, you know, go out and use animal skins for warmth in winter, or the brains enough to jump in a river or a lake or whatever and cool off in summer, what have you. But by the same token, the ability of humans to live on the planet exists in a very narrow band. We like to think that we are incredibly adaptable as human beings, Jim, because, oh, look, well, we've got people who never see the temperature rise much above freezing, and they've lived meaningful and full lives above the Arctic Circle, and then there are people who can live in the desert and never know what rain is. And my goodness, aren't we amazing, an amazing species? No, we're not. We are an adaptable species, but the range in which we can live as a species itself is quite narrow. Yesterday in Death Valley, it got within 4 degrees of the record for heat there. 4 degrees, and you can't live in that heat. And it was what in Vegas. 119 degrees, and the same in Phoenix? Well, here's a hint. It's hard to have any kind of sustainable culture in that kind of heat. Just like it's hard to have sustainable culture in the freezing cold of the dead south of the Arctic, of the Antarctic Pole.
Right. Well, see, I used to live in Las Vegas. I lived out there for 15, 16 years, and like that little heat wave being sarcastic, the heat wave they had, 100 and that hottest I think it was out there in the years I lived out there was about 115, 116. Now that is hot. I got used to 100. That was nothing. But once it gets over 110, and I heard you talk about this a week or so, about 100, you know, and it is a dry heat, but you feel it. But
yeah, it's still hot.
Yeah. Don't walk on the sidewalk barefoot, you know. But my point about that little heat thing, I remember got about in the 110 high teens one time. That was, I got through in there 10 years. But I noticed, because I checked it out on the Weather Channel, it was like 100 teens for about 4 or 5 days. And to me, and to my post-reptilian brain, that kind of indicates there's a little climate change at work. You know what I mean?
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
There's that old line about it's hard to get a person to understand something when his paycheck depends on not understanding. And,
well,
you know, even though the Koch brothers don't get a paycheck, it's their money. And their money has made them absolutely stupid. The Koch brothers' money has made them dumber than the average guy putting a straw in a bottle of Everclear and just slurping away.
Yeah. Well, I mean, everybody's like that to some extent. I mean, except the quote-unquote entrepreneurs who can figure out a way. I mean, you got to get your job to pay your bills. And just like those people in West Virginia who have to work in the coal mines, you may even know that that's the only job you can get. You got to do what you got to do to feed your family or whatever, or even feed yourself. You want to get out of it, but then you get stuck in a situation, you know, where you're there. But, you know, unless you can start some sort of business or win the lottery or something like that, you're pretty much stuck doing that.
Yeah, and some of that has to do with the Republicans, Jim, like to talk about a culture of dependency. Well, if you want to see the ultimate culture of dependency, it's the culture of dependency where, because your great-granddaddy was a coal miner, you think that you've got a constitutional right to be a coal miner, too. And so instead of going off to college and, I don't know, learning to be a CPA or, Don Blankenship went off to college and learned how to be an accountant, and he came back and, he wound up killing 29 or 30 or 40 people. Who knows? There are means of improving yourself as long as you don't think that you've got, that there's something in the universe that demands that you be something else or be the same thing. You know, once upon a time, in medieval Europe, if your daddy was a hide tanner, you too were going to be a hide tanner.
Yeah,
and supposedly everything about this country was designed to go the opposite way. That this would be a meritocracy, that this would be a classless society, except for the fact that, for the most part, people didn't want that.
Right. Well, I mean, even with people's last names to some extent, Smith, Taylor, it probably goes back. To some extent, somebody in past generations.
Right, Butcher, right. Sure.
Yeah. Well, it was really really great to let you go, let somebody else get on the line, but once again, that was just, and also about the, you know, those 19 firefighters, but it seems like those kind of quote-unquote natural disasters are almost occurring every month or so, and in natural disasters, I will include the mass killings that seem to pop up every couple of months.
Yeah, and you know what? In the story of the Arizona fire, there was one that struck me as particularly telling. It was a fellow talking about having to get up and get out because the fires were coming, and it burned his house down. And he said, I lay down to take a nap, and that jumped out of my skin when my wife came and woke me up and said, quick, we got to get out because the fire's coming. And do you know that that individual, he had four classic cars. Do you know that it was a fire race breathing down his back, he was trying to get at least one hot rod on a trailer to drive out with him?
That's, the irony in that is so incredible, because if you think about it, the hot rod produces greenhouse, causes the climate change, and yet that's what he's trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me of, I think I've got my chronology right. After the Spanish invaded Tenochtitlan down in the Valley of Mexico, eventually things turned very, very badly. And this was after they had extorted all the gold they could out of the Mexica culture. And they had to beat a hasty retreat from Tenochtitlan. I think it's referred to as La Noche Triste, the sorrow for the sad night. And a whole bunch of Cortez's men loaded themselves down with as much gold as they could carry. And eventually one of the causeways, because ancient Tenochtitlan sat on a series of islands that had been actually manufactured by human endeavor, and on a lake, and there were causeways across the lake to the mainland. And at one point, one of them collapsed or had been sabotaged or whatever, and the guys carrying all that gold is heavy. Archimedes figured that out. And the guys with their bags laden with gold sank into the waters of Lake Texcoco and into the bottom of the mud and died. They drowned because what they possessed them. You know, you think about something like, and it just goes to show how your mindset is different. I think about a fire, and the first thing that comes to mind is A, the safety of my family. And only after that's attended to, I think about things like photographs that can never be replaced, the quilts that my mother made with her own hands. Just about everything else can be replaced, including a hot rod or a classic car.
Well, did the guy make it out with his car?
No. No. The fire came on so fast that they had to scoot.
Well,
it consumed their entire home.
It's obvious Jesus didn't want him to keep that hot rod. He wanted that hot rod up in car heaven so Jesus could drive around.
Right. Maybe that's the holy rolls he'll come back on when the time comes. Exactly.
All right, Bob, I'm going to let you go.
All right, Jim, good to hear from you.
All right.
Take care now. Bye. Jim, calling from Louisiana, Stan. Note coming in from Dr. John. Subject line, humans, culture, and climate. We can live in a fairly wide temperature range compared with many species. Biological reactions are part of it, sweating, shivering. But culture gives us an edge. Igloos shelter us in the Arctic. Stilt houses let us deal with periodic flooding, for example. But adapting to change is always a problem. Biological adaptation is slow. Cultural adaptation can be constrained by past decisions. Can we remake Miami's skyscrapers on stilts? Do we have the will? Moreover, can we deal with the cost and inconvenience required to slow climate catastrophe? And those are the real questions. And again, thank you, Dr. John. Again, you know, the thing, he uses the word, he says, cultural adaptation can be constrained by past decisions. And past decisions include things like, why isn't it always warm down here? Well, you know, we survived the occasional hurricane, and we should be. But you know what? No, when it goes all Atlantis, that's it. and there is little more than 75 years or so to deal with this. I say 75 years ago, like, you know, we're going to be here to see it. Some of us will. You know, my grandchildren may live to see this. And you feel an imposition of obligation to do what you can when you can. But how do you deal with a Miami? I mean, that story by Jeff Goodell, Goodbye Miami, was published in Rolling Stone. How many Action News team coverage stories have been done on that in the greater Miami area? And how many of those stories involved going to some godforsaken climate change denier and say, oh, no. If anything, we'll probably be higher up above sea level because them little Keebler elves under the earth is making new dirt all the time. That's just a bunch of alarmist bull. You know, the myths that are contained in the Old Testament, I'm thinking of Noah here, are myths. But myths are the vehicle by which pre-literate societies transmitted their wisdom. And you can read the Noah myth, the flood myth, for instance, which was not original. They had picked it up off of some previous cultures and come up with it by themselves. Most human cultures don't. Everything's an admixture of things from other places. But the Noah myth can be seen as a warning that sometimes one person does have the answer, and the wisdom of the rest of the polity or the group or the tribe may not be right. That sometimes one person can have the vision that can save other people, but they have to be willing to listen. And the way that the Noah story plays out, most folks didn't listen, and they died. Now, I'm not arguing for a literal interpretation of the Bible by any stretch of the imagination. But in a literary interpretation of that old text, that collection of myths, there's something there to be believed. There's something there to be taken to heart. And you know how I feel about the word believe. Something there to be taken to heart. That maybe, just maybe, the few lone voices crying in the wilderness about what's going to happen to Miami in 100 years are right. And the sad half of that myth is that a whole lot of people are going to die because they will not listen. You could not move me and mine to Florida if you offered me a mansion on the beach. You couldn't do it. We got a lot of friends in Florida, and I worry about them. When the hurricanes come, I worry. And when I read Goodbye Miami, I don't necessarily worry about them, but I worry about the people that they plan on loving, that they do love, who will be here 75 years from now. 75 years is nothing! Even in human terms, in terms of little creatures whose lives are so very short. It's nothing. In 75 years, Rome went from an inspired autocrat named Octavian to the end of his line in Nero, who kicked his pregnant wife to death. I stand out in the yard, and I remember my grandmother, who was born in 1894, telling me, standing in this same yard, 40 years ago, I remember the first time I saw an airplane. electric lights have been, an electric culture has been here for most Americans in a shorter span of time than it will take for South Florida to become a marshy archipelago. The smart people will get the out of South Florida. If there's even a moderate chance that your kids will have kids who will live in South Florida, get out now. Go. Stand not upon the order of your going, but go at once. Oh, Christ. If I'm starting to sound like Alex Jones, somebody shoot me a note. Merciful God. Hey, welcome to the program.
Yes, John from D.C.
Hey, John, what's happening?
Hey, do you have a specific topic that you're talking about tonight?
Have you not been listening to the show?
No, I've been listening. I heard climate change and some other stuff, but is there anything else in particular? Or
There's more in the stack, but you bring it to the table.
Well, I mean, this is kind of redundant given the amount of related stories during the week, but what was Paula Deen thinking? I mean, have you discussed that?
We've kind of Paula Deen
over that.
But if you've got a take, bring it on.
Well, I mean, it just seems like one more example of an old conservative person, you know, being an old conservative person. I guess that's kind of, you know, that's why I said it's kind of redundant. But I mean, what else did you have in the stack tonight?
Oh, I haven't even begun to get to it. No, just bring on what you got.
I mean, it just seems like it's one more example of the dinosaurs in America kind of poking out of the tar pit before they sink, you know. And that's basically what I see as far as the present sort of power struggle. You know, right now, I mean, we're all about, you know, and I realize, I know what your take is on democracy, but I realize, you know, we're like, oh, freedom, liberty, democracy, yada, yada, yada. And then you got these people like Paula Deen or, you know, any of the Republicans basically just saying, you know what, F freedom. The Republicans don't like freedom. They just want basically a dictatorship. So it's just, I mean, basically what I see right now in America is a struggle between people who are trying to emerge into the 21st century and people who are trying to drag everyone back into the 1950s.
Let me back up just a minute, John.
Mm-hmm.
We want to think, but I don't necessarily know that we are absolutely correct in our thinking. We want to think that Paula Deen is one of the dinosaurs going whoop before they go floop under the tar pit.
Right.
We want to think that. We want to convince ourselves that. We desperately want to believe it because we want to think that somehow this country will evolve past the hate that's contained in her stupidity. But as I pointed out the other night, she's 66 years old. Okay, now when I was 25, somebody who was 66, let me see, 88, was somebody who was born in 1922. Well, I'm 50 now, and she's 66, and 66 in 2013 means somebody who was born in 1947. She's a baby boomer. Okay, so she's not a dinosaur. She was born after the explosion of the first atomic bomb. Okay, she was born as jets were going into the sky. Now the fact that she lived in some sort of privileged situation in Georgia or whatever, and was somehow still exposed to racial epithets. Well, daggummit, John. You won't have to go far in Georgia or Tennessee or Alabama or Boston to hear somebody using the word that she used. Okay?
Yeah.
Those aren't, they're not dinosaurs. Oh, hell no. No. So that, you know, there's an abundance of work to be done. You know what? I will take, and this is not by way of defending Paula Deen, it's just an observation on the differences between individual and institutional racism, I'll take, you know, let Paula Deen holler that word to the top of her lungs. There are still some people that are going to, you know, she's lost several million dollars in contracts, but they're still showing up at her restaurant. So she's not going on the beans and cornbread diet anytime soon, except for the fact that that's one of the things that she knows how to make really well.
Yeah.
She's okay. But compare that to the institutional racism that is embodied in the Voting Rights Act decision of last week. I'll take Paula Deen all day long if we're going to compare the two. Because racism that is enshrined institutionally is much more pernicious, perfidious, and profound than the ignorance of one pale lady who, that wedding. I want to do one of them Annie Bellum themed weddings, you know, just like Gone with the Wind with the little pickaninnies running around in bow ties. Jesus criminy, please.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think? Because I mean, I totally agree with you. I prefer Paula Deen over Scalia any day. I just think that it's like, I mean, even Scalia is a perfect example of the dinosaur too, in my opinion. I understand what you're saying. It's still pervasive, but at the same time, globalization, the sort of cultural integration that we're going through seems to me so vast that it would be impossible for anyone but the most remote cabin dweller to not, you know, understand it or not.
Hey, take it easy on the cabins. Those things are pretty sustainable sometimes. Okay, well, I'm not disagreeing with you just for the sake of it, but I got another one for you.
Okay.
This is out of The Advance, which is a newspaper published in Vidalia, Georgia. And it publishes pieces by people in the community, like many small newspapers do. You know, folks don't have paying jobs writing for the newspaper, but they like to see their names and their words in print. And so there's this cat by the name of, his name's Alan. Jerry with a G, Alan. And I thought of this because you mentioned globalization and how, right, you know, the world's becoming a smaller place and we're all realizing that we're part of the same human. No. This is a column in The Advance under their heading Plain Talk. The article is titled An Arab Spring or an Arab Fall. Okay?
Right.
And remember, we're in Georgia State. Paula Deen country, as it were. In 2013, you're going to be hard-pressed to prove to me that any column that begins with a reference to Rudyard Kipling is going to end anywhere good. I could do it. I don't know if a lot of other people could. I know the Horn audience could. But in this case, Jerry Allen says, Rudyard Kipling is one of my favorite authors. Uh-oh. Now, this is the guy who created the idea of the white man's burden, right?
Yeah, white man, the poem, yeah.
And Gunga Deen, which is its own little pocket of racism, white supremacy, even though it comes out with the native person looking better than the white guy. But Rudyard Kipling is one of my favorite authors, Jerry Allen writes. He once said, East is east and west is west and never the twain will meet. As I watch the Middle East slowly deteriorate, I understand his wisdom. The Middle East is a place with fanatically held beliefs. Well, he hasn't been to Westboro Baptist, has he? A properly trained Muslim male will gladly murder his mother, his wife, his children, or anyone who does not conform to his religious beliefs. He sees virtue in totally dominating women and girls. He sees evil in allowing females to get educated, That's some fine English construction there, John, just fine. And step out of the shadows. Actually, they really don't favor educating anybody in anything but mayhem. So, no offense, John, but that kind of takes the winds out of your globalization sails there. You know what I mean?
I totally understand what you're saying, but, I mean, And again, I'm not being disagreeable to be disagreeable, because, of course, like I said before, I agree with most of what you say. But in this instance, it's like that's an example of I realize it's been going on for a long time, probably one of the oldest struggles in the world. But that's still a somewhat pocketed section of the world. I mean, you still, like we said last time, you still got China, India, Africa, Europe. There's still plenty of places in the world that people can be aware of that don't include, you know, fanatics in some Middle Eastern country. And I totally understand your point. I get it. It's like, basically, this is an obvious example of someone, you know, relegating someone from a different country to enemy status, rightfully, you know, I understand his point, but at the same time, I understand yours, too. But what I'm trying to say is there are more countries in the world than just, you know, the fanatics in the Middle East.
Well, yeah, there's more the countries in general. Yeah, there's a country in the world with a boatload of fanatics in the United States, and more than most people are willing to admit. Those fanatics allowed their own band of fanatical leaders to take over one half of the Congress and to run the other half from a minority position.
Well, you're right, and I guess that's where I see, you know, the dinosaurs versus the people walking upright. You know, I see us as in the progressives, you, me, the horn audience, as people trying to move into the 21st century, and the Republicans as the dinosaurs. And I don't think that guy you had on the other night, I was listening to him, he was like, oh yeah, I'm this total hippie from somewhere, and my lawyer's, he's a Republican, but he's not that bad. And I was just, oh my gosh, I was just about ready to, you have no idea. I was like, what the hell? I mean, what the fuck? Pardon me. Wait, I'm sorry.
That's okay. We're on the internet.
I was pissed off. I was like, what the hell is he talking about? Great, so we found one Republican that isn't a total Nazi. Whoop-de-frickin'-do. That doesn't mean that the Republican Party is a reasonable, rational party. And just, I mean, no offense to you, because, you know, all respect. But at the same time, it's like, why was he continuing to talk? Why was he, I'm getting off topic. But
well, because it's a conversation. I mean,
yeah, I know, but he kept saying the same thing in very slightly different ways. Yeah, but you know, there's some Republicans that are kind of okay. Yeah, like 1%. And most of them are just too stupid to realize that, you know, they're not keeping up with the rest of the SS Stormtroopers. I mean, I think that basically what we've got is people who are never going to understand that there's a difference between one person's personal opinions and another's, and just because one person has a belief doesn't mean everyone has to live by that. I'm not saying that the Republicans have to agree with me. I'm just saying that there are some obvious facts like climate change, like globalization, like you know, not letting the big banks and the corporations buy politicians, that people should understand and try to overcome. You know, try to get over. You know, that's my point. Republicans are never going to get it. They're never going to get it. And I agree with you in that degree that we're not kind of moving necessarily to the 21st century, because the Republican Party is never going to move there. In 10 years, they're still going to be where they were in the 1980s. You know, in 20 years, they might be where they were in the mid-90s. So I agree with you on that aspect, but I think the rest of the world and the rest of America, which still includes at least 150 million people, are trying to move into the 21st century, and that's what I support.
I understand what you're saying, John. And let me be clear about something. I don't know how this happened, but I've had a couple of notes along the way saying, you know, you're really putting some stuff out there that it just seems a little far-fetched.
I don't think you put anything out there that's far-fetched. I think you should keep doing what you're doing. If you put more
well,
stuff
but,
out.
And, but with that as a prologue, John, let me say this. I'll go ahead and go this far. If we take as a given the idea that the rest of the world is interested in doing something about climate change, do you realize that the United States by ignoring the problem, we'll be able to negate the efforts of the entire rest of the world? I mean, like was pointed out, the Chinese are bringing on as many windmills or wind farms as they are coal-fired power plants.
Right.
India is trying to do something with renewable energy.
Yeah.
Germany will be off the freaking hydrocarbon grid, but good, in less than 20 years. So will the vast majority of Scandinavia. So probably will Brazil.
Yeah.
All these countries and all these regions are making all these efforts. But at the end of the day, if the United States does not do something,
right,
then it all comes to naught. And that's a tough place to be philosophically for a progressive person to contemplate, because regardless of what the Republicans think, we love our country. And we would love for our country to live up. It's like what Dr. Bill was saying earlier today. The idea of American exceptionalism is not over. It has not been accomplished. American exceptionalism is a phrase that has just been sadly and sickly abused. It's not a function of, you know, whether or not we can get to the, you know, conquer the continent. It's not, or whether we can buy and sell more stuff. As Dr. Bill pointed out in one of his lectures, American exceptionalism is an exceptionalism that is born of community effort. It is the exact polar opposite of anything that a Republican says American exceptionalism is. And most of all, as he noted this afternoon, it is not yet accomplished.
Yeah, but Republicans...
So wait. Okay? Because I kind of ran off there for a minute.
I want to get to the idea.
Okay, so if we agree philosophically that as the crisis deepens, the climate crisis deepens, and the United States continues to dither and engage in the minuscule baby steps, while the rest of the world is trying to be serious about it and do something, well, when the bad times come and the rest of the world realizes that we really are the problem and that we're not going to get on board and try to solve the problem unless we're forced to, well, what does the word force mean to you, John?
Adversarial situation.
War.
Right.
And we've never
we've
never had one of those bombers crossing the Atlantic and Pacific kind of situations.
But I think I understand what you're saying. I totally agree with I agree with it. I agree that, you know, we're such a massive factor in the world, in the entire Earth's future, that it's impossible not to ignore that. But at the same time, I think that, you know, at the same time that I've sometimes, you know, complained about the fact that, you know, we don't really appreciate the technology we have, it's actually somewhat of a good thing, because we're so eager to develop our technology that we can't get out ahead of it. In other words, I don't think that it's possible for Germany and China and India and all these other countries to keep ignoring what's obviously a dilemma with as much information as is getting out there. Even as much as the fascists in this country might try to stop it, I think that there's no way that, you know, I mean, I guess your point is correct in that if it's too late in, say, a decade, then yeah, I don't really see, you know, I guess it's going to be hard for any kind of reversal to happen, but I don't know if that's true.
Well, you know, Sun Tzu in The Art of War said the first rule of war is to try to stay out of it, I think.
Right.
And then he said, the second rule is, if you're going to be in one, for God's sakes, pick your own ground. And by ground, you know, and the beautiful thing about reading The Art of War is that there's 500 years worth of commentary on what these simple sentences mean. And your ground means not only your ground, but your time of day, your time of month, your time of year. Right. Imagine for a moment an America that has gone blundering blithely along for the next 75 years until Miami's underwater, until there is a massive crisis-based out-migration of human beings.
Right.
Which we will not, if the Republicans have their way, be able to financially deal with, because they will have, remember, drowned the government in a bathtub.
Well, I think the Republicans have already accomplished that to a certain degree, especially with examples like Halliburton and KBR.
Oh, no. They haven't gotten anywhere close to what they hope to accomplish.
Okay. No, I'm not denying that.
And so in that moment, in a moment of profound weakness and extremis, the rest of the world says enough. Enough already. They've got to be brought to heel. In that moment, we will be able to be brought to heel. There is a reason that the so-called smart guys of the Joint Chiefs of Staff list global climate change as the greatest national security threat to the overall integrity of the United States that we face. With all compassion for anyone who lost anyone in the 2001 attacks of September 11th. Those could go on, and that could happen once a year for the next 100 years, and it wouldn't bring this country down. But we cannot survive what is coming at us in the form of climate change.
Well, didn't someone over in like CENTCOM or something already comment on this? Already comment on the climate change thing? Like a big wig over there?
Yeah. And they have said repeatedly that it is the greatest, gravest national security threat to the United States in the sovereign integrity.
I think, I understand what you're saying. I think that we're kind of like faced here with two sort of analytical discussions. The first one is a philosophical one about human ego and the challenge of it, and the second one is one of, I guess, accepting reality, you know, and accepting the fact, like you just said, you know, there could be whatever, but it's nothing compared to, you know, worldwide climactic natural disasters. I mean, that's basically like, you know, we can't stop weather. Weather is weather for a reason. You know, we can't stop a 2-mile-wide tornado because it's a 2-mile-wide tornado. It's not a
major. Well, wait, it's not just a matter of stopping a 2-mile-wide tornado.
Oh, I'm just using that as an example.
No, but I want to address that one in particular because we must understand, John, the nature of the problem we face. You've got thousands, tens of thousands, maybe a million, and that's 1/325th of the country, and that's a big lot of people, maybe more than that, who tune into a guy who says that the government has some secret nefarious ability to steer tornadoes. You know, Alex Jones.
All right. Yeah, I mean, that's so stupid. I mean, basically, so wait, hold on. So let me get this straight. He thinks that the government can control tornadoes, 2-mile-wide tornadoes, but Putin's still in power. That's what he's saying. He's saying that the CIA or the NSA, whoever's controlling these tornadoes, and of course I know they're not, but whoever he's thinking they are wouldn't use them against Putin? Like, give me a friggin' break. What the hell? Yeah, okay. I mean, there's so many Republican talking points that you could just like, okay, well, obviously this is untrue because this is something that would happen if it was, and it's not. So that's just one more. I mean, yeah, Alex Jones is an example of making, you know, tons of money off zero intelligence, because if he knew what he was talking about, yeah, I don't think that he would be very popular right now, much less successful.
Well, I mean, apparently there's no money in candor, but there's big money in putting forward ludicrous fantasies.
Well, no offense, but that's exemplified by you. I mean, you're a intellectual, smart, truth-telling, you know, commentator, and yet you don't have the billions of dollars that Rush Limbaugh does because he spews BS.
Yeah, and so. it's hard to figure out how you would package buy gold now ads inside this format. it's just I mean it, I think we've got a better chance of getting cold fusion going on a, you know, on a gallon jug basis.
Right. Now I don't. Okay. Now, so here's the thing: we got these two conversations. We got the philosophical, which is basically we as a species are so egotistic that we won't address certain problems that face everyone. But because we're so kind of wrapped up in little minutiae of interest, we won't address the bigger, more obvious problems like climate change. And then the other one is I guess it kind of ties into the first, but not directly, which is basically addressing the inability to focus on that priority. You know, that's I don't.
Yeah, they're the same conversation, John.
Well, I mean, I think that the conversation about ego is a little bit different because it deals directly with the human psyche and sociological development, whereas the other deals more with societal priorities, you know, more directly with that. I mean, I think that if as a society we put less energy into, helping people like Rush Limbaugh and put more priorities in helping people like you, then, you know, we'd be fine. But, you know.
Yeah, but I'm not able to, and not I, we, the Horn family, unless we got, you know, up to, you know, if we got up around the, you know, million listener range, then we could start affecting public policy on a grand scale. As it is, you know, we do little projects here and there, and we try just to make sure that we do not sit silently by while people run over us. You know, that's why when the Secretary of Energy says that we can have low carbon coal, well, you know, I get the tennis ball out and the duct tape and just, because at that point language becomes useless to me. Low carbon coal. Yeah.
Well, I mean, please don't ever listen to anyone who tells you that you're putting, you know, too many ideas out. Don't, please, just if they say that, know that they're probably intimidated and you should do the opposite, put more ideas out. I just don't, at least you're doing this. I mean, that's more than most people. So I don't know, I just think that, I mean, what do you think that realistically, because I know obviously the Day After Tomorrow movie is, you know, it's meant as a parody somewhat. But at the same time, what do you think is the realistic possibility of that kind of climate change and in what amount of time? Are we talking, we're definitely talking decades, right? I mean.
Well, no, what scares the piss out of me is the fact, John, that all of these estimates by all of these climatologists and all of these respected peer-reviewed journal publishing scientists is that they have routinely and consistently said, listen, we're underestimating. We are deliberately underestimating. So when they say 100 years, it could be 50.
Wow. Realistically? I mean, it could actually...
Yeah, realistically.
Wow.
They've not been proven wrong. They have been proven too, and here's one of those words, too conservative in their estimates. It's happening now. The storms are getting stronger. The tornadoes, you know, with their rack and pinion steering, are getting broader.
Right.
The sea level rise is more than it has been anticipated thus far. The Arctic ice cap was not supposed to be gone by now.
Yeah.
And the right wing goes, well, see, it's happened faster than that's why they're wrong.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mentioned Noah a little bit ago. There's a joke out there, the punchline of which is, and God said to Noah, how long can you tread water? Well, that's us.
Right. Yeah, I don't understand, like, how, okay, I mean, I know I say this sometimes, but I just, how is it that if we got people who barely do anything being reprimanded and accosted by the, you know, society in general, and then you got people who are basically stealing fortunes by ripping off homeowners through corporate rules and regulations that are just like, okay, yeah, so we're ruining the climate, so what? That's obvious proof that we're right. I mean, is that really what people agree with? Is that, I don't, I don't understand how people... It just seems like such an Alice in Wonderland kind of world, you know? I mean, obviously it's not, but it just it seems like those are the rules the Republicans live by. You know, it's bizarro world for them. Up is down, left is right. And
no, I mean, they're taking their cues from the Bible, too. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die.
Okay, but...
He who dies with the most toys wins.
Let's just say, and I'm definitely not doing this. Let's just say you're looking at it from a Republican viewpoint. Okay, don't they think that God would appreciate them taking care of the earth?
No, because God gave them dominion over the earth, and that means they get to do with it whatever they want to. And besides, the rapture's coming anyway, and they're all going to fly off in the clouds, either fully clothed or naked. They're not quite sure which. And then God's just going to rain a shitstorm on the rest of us, and they're going to sit up in the clouds with their harps, plucking away "It Sucks to Be You" on the harp. Now, the more rational among these right-wing get-it-while-the-getting's-good weirdos have another approach, and it's manifested, frankly, in the Secretary of Energy's comments. We got all these problems, but science will solve them for us. You know, eventually, science will teach us how to capture all the carbon. Great.
Are you serious? That's actually their attitude?
Yeah, and I got another note here from Jay, who writes and says, by the way, Halliburton, KBR, and Parsons think they can build a seawall all the way around Florida and make a few trillion dollars doing it. So that's how they plan to keep Florida from sinking beneath the wave 100 years from now. Because, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now, they'll get a few trillion to build a giant seawall that's going to apparently encompass the entire Atlantic seaboard.
I don't even know where to start on the level of pitiful that is. So basically, they're literally saying...
Their analysis, John, begins with, how can we make a buck off this?
Right.
Okay? I mean, that's the way corporate culture works in America. The first inquiry is, whatever the problem is, how can we make a buck off of it? I mean, mm-hmm. if you've got kids falling out of trees, how can we make a buck out of kids falling out of trees? The most glaring example of this is in the wake of the Sandy Hook Newtown massacre.
Oh, the pink rifles?
No. Well, I mean, there's that. But in the wake of the Sandy Hook Newtown massacre, companies began coming out with Kevlar backpacks for your school-age child.
Jesus.
And Kevlar vests for your school-age child. And Kevlar naptime mats for your school-age child. So the analysis begins with, whatever the problem is, how can we make a buck out of it? Okay? In 20 years, the science will be good enough that we can take all the carbon out of coal, but it'll still be coal, and it'll still provide energy, and cool, we'll be really rich. Because the beginning analysis is, how can we make a buck out of it? And the final analysis is, and then we'll be really rich.
Okay, but the thing is that the problem with this quote-unquote seawall is that ignores all the other accompanying weather events that would happen if that did happen in actuality.
No, they're going to put a televangelist out in front of the seawall who will pray the hurricanes away.
Oh my gosh. That's so frustrating. Like, okay, so I
welcome to my world.
That makes no sense. That makes zero sense. It's like, obviously, if you got a problem and you're so desperate that you're making up Kevlar backpacks, then maybe there's something else that should be done with that, as in legislation or laws or things that people can...
No, because this is a country run by corporations, okay? And the only obligation that a corporation has is, how can we make a buck? Or actually, how can we make a lot of bucks? That's all they've got. Now, if you're in the Kevlar vest business, well,
You can make a buck by providing Kevlar backpacks and nap time mats to freaking toddlers so they won't be stitched in two when they're, going to nap time.
Okay, I mean, I totally understand what you're saying, and I get it, and I agree with it. But let's just not because I want to, just because I just spend a second, couple seconds considering this from the stupid standpoint of the Republicans, okay? So say you look at it from their standpoint. What they're saying is that God and Jesus loved this world. It was so great. They made a whole first book of Genesis about it. But Republicans think that they're supposed to destroy all that?
No, they can if they want to, and the faster they do it, the sooner Jesus comes.
Wow. And they don't think that great-grandchildren will be affected by this, and God would probably prefer that great-grandchildren had successful, nice lives?
No, because they're just going to be little snowflake baby souls that are still bouncing around up in heaven, playing their little snowflake baby soul harps.
What kind of realm of reality is that?
Obviously.
Man, all right. I don't even know. Like what? I'm so bewildered by this. It's like what do they do? They get up thinking it's like what? Like two thoughts. What can I be scared of? And how can I make money? Is that basically what the Republicans do?
Yeah. And the trick for us, since we started talking about climate change, is to figure out a way to really convince them that they can get really, really rich dealing with climate change from a proactive, sane standpoint. Because there's a hell of a lot of money to be made out there, and a lot of people are already making it.
The Chinese know that, and so do the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I mean, don't stop. If anyone says to you, stop putting ideas out, or you're putting too many things out, don't even listen to that. I know you don't, but just please don't ever do that. Like, I remember the first time I heard you, I was like, what's going on here? This must be going on in like Canada or something. Because there's literally no one on the radio, no one broadcasting who sounds anything remotely like you. So you can't stop, like, no matter what.
Well, you know, as long as we keep the lights on, we'll keep going.
Yeah, man, were there any other things that, you know, I mean, I'm just trying to think, because there's so much that's going on this week, like Snowden, like what's up with Snowden? Like, who, have you talked about that?
Yeah, and I've gotten myself in a world of crap for it, too, so I'm just sort of...
Oh, okay. No, I understand.
You know, apparently he's in the Moscow airport, and he's not out of the Moscow airport yet because he doesn't have a passport.
Did he mistakenly think that Putin is a nice guy?
I don't know. See, that's the thing. We don't know in this circumstance what he thought about anything. He's getting, as far as I can tell, some really lousy advice. Among other things, up until his flight to Moscow, he was, if for instance you were his lawyer, you know, the first thing a lawyer tells a criminal defendant, or even a lawyer tells a civil client, is quit talking. Listen, I'm your lawyer now. Anything that needs to be said about the case, I'll say. Right. Your job is shutting up.
Right.
And apparently nobody ever told Ed Snowden that. And he's made his case worse and worse and worse and worse.
Wow.
So, you know, who knows what kind of advice he got. But, well, you know, it's all very weird. I heard that quote from his dad that just drove me crazy. Snowden's dad said, yeah, I haven't seen him in a long time. You know, I think he's betrayed the United States government, but I don't think he's betrayed the people. And I wanted to put my foot through a piece of wallboard or something.
The government represents the people, so...
The government is the people. That's how the Constitution starts. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, achieve domestic tranquility,
provide for the general welfare, provide for the common defense, you know, defense is like fourth on the list, do establish and ordain this Constitution of the United States, blah, 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 blah. We the people. But see, that the reason I wanted to kick furniture, John, is because in that little clip, I heard the triumph of republicanism and libertarianism.
How do you mean? Oh, okay, I understand.
Because the libertarians in particular have been drumbeating, and the John Birchers and the tea baggers and all these assorted and sundry ignorant bastards have been babbling on about how, you know, I love my country, but I hate the government, when they are the government, or at least they're supposed to be. And now they own one branch of it, and they're still not happy. And the country's going to hell in a handbasket. And so, you know, in that moment when Ed Snowden's father says, I think he betrayed the government, but he didn't betray the people.
Yeah.
I know that that our side has largely, and it's not surprising because we're, you know, we're kind of like that traveling team that always played against the Harlem Globetrotters. What were they, the Washington Generals?
Okay.
Progressives are largely like them. You know, our role is to be beaten because we're just not very good at anything else. So, for instance, you know, all those years when the only people out there doing progressive radio were people like Mike Malloy, and then there were, you know, 100 right-wingers out there. Well, the government, you've got to drown it in the bathtub. My friends, bring me a little Dominican boy. You know, all of that stuff. Well, you know what? It only took about 30 years, but now you got Ed Snowden's dad saying there's a difference between the government and the people. Hell, even the criminal case that has been brought against Snowden is the people of the United States versus Edward Snowden.
Yeah, I think...
Now, I understand there's some, I understand there's a lot of shading in all of that. And right. The degree to which we the people really are in charge of the government is substantially in question. But honest to God, you know, if you just give up on the idea of popular sovereignty, and you give up on the idea of government by the people, of the people, and for the people, you know, Lincoln used that phrase at Gettysburg 50 right. years ago this November, by the way. Or 150 years ago this November, he said, so that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth.
Yeah.
Well, it mostly has. Or the idea of it has. Because Ed Snowden's daddy can say, well, he's betrayed the government, but he hadn't betrayed the people.
Well, I mean, I think that's a perfect example of Bobby Jindal's version of stupid. Remember, Jindal was like, Republicans have to be stop being so stupid or something like that? I mean, I think that's what he was talking about. It's like, perfect example, Snowden's father. I mean, he's basically like every Republican male that exists now. I mean, they're all basically like these dumb KKK, hood-wearing, swastika, goose-stepping... I don't even know... The stereotypes are so unfortunately true to their nature. I don't even know where to stop. I mean, they're basically all like that. And I wish I could say that's a generalization, and that's just me kind of like, I don't know, being stereotypical or stereotyping. But it's not. I mean, if you look at people like Lindsey Graham or who's that guy, you know, Boomer.
Oh, you know, Louis. People, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, they are literally all like that. And even when they try to be nice, they look like vipers. You know, they sound like vipers. I wish I could say that there's some, like, okay, Olympia Snow, like I said, she's had her good aspects. She's had her good attributes. Okay, in my opinion, that's an example of a good Republican. But there are so many more Republicans that I'm not even going to waste my time telling you, yeah, but Bob, there are actually some good Republicans, because there aren't. For the most part, they're not good. They're mostly fascist, racist, xenophobic, sexist, bigots.
Freaks.
You know. Yeah, I just, yeah, exactly. I just, I mean, there are very few exceptions, and the ones that are the exceptions I've found are just too naive, you know, to go along with the SS march. I mean, I've literally met Republicans who don't even know, like, if you tell them what their party's actually doing, they'll look at you like, what, wait, really? And these are like full-grown adults. It's like, do you realize what the Republicans are doing? Do you understand what they stand for? I'm like, what do you mean? I'll be like, well, okay, who's that guy? Rick Scott from Florida? I try to explain to this lady, you realize Rick Scott has like he's got a conflict of interest down there, and that you got to kind of pay attention to that if you're paying attention to his policy? And she just looked at me. This is like a 43-year-old woman. And she was like, what are you talking about? I'm like, lady, you're
looking at you like a cow looking at a new gate.
Exactly. Like, what are you talking about? You support the Republicans. How do you not know what Rick Scott is doing and what his conflict of interest is? Like, what do you want?
Yeah, but he loves Jesus. and he's for capitalism and the free market. Glory be to God. Listen, you know, don't cast your pearls before swine, okay? I mean, just don't. Because you'll wind up being a furniture kicker, and then you'll hurt your foot like I have.
Yeah. No, I know. I'm just trying to.
I mean, when you run down the middle of Main Street going, you know, they'll pick you up and give you the purple crayon and the straitjacket.
right.
No, well, listen, John, you have a good evening. It's been a wonderful conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. I'll call in soon.
Yeah, do please. And by the way, Marty tells you, out of that list that you used to describe Republicans, you left out misogynistic.
Well, that was sexist, so, yeah.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Thank you, Bob.
Take care, John. Bye.
Thank you.
Calling from the D.C. area? That was John. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jeremy, what's happening?
Goddamn Bob Miller, the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs a few hundred million years ago did that. They're farming, they're chopping stuff until they blow up when they're all killed off by that little climatic event.
I was thinking about that wee tiny little mammal that was running around that managed to survive whatever killed off the last of the... Yeah. And the last of the dinosaurs, I mean, come on, we still got alligators.
No, the dinosaurs are still here. We just don't think of it every day. The dinosaurs are the birds, no joke.
We've had that conversation in the past, and I got called out on it. I used to think the same thing, but apparently not.
There's a couple things out there which make Bob wonder one way or another. There's a show on the Sunday Channel called The Real Story. And they did one on Jurassic Park. Now, we've all heard about Velociraptor. They're not what they portrayed in the movie. Yes, they're nasty little things, but they're about a third the size they showed them in the movie. The Velociraptor they portrayed is actually a different kind of dinosaur. And it's actually an herbivore. So they did give that up a little bit. But in the end,
Wait. The guy who played Newman on Seinfeld actually got eaten by an herbivore?
That was a lot. That was something else. But yes, similar. Yes, the one that they portrayed.
Oh, that's
in
right.
The
that
meteor.
Was the one with the multicolored fan thing. Yeah, that.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. The one that spit. Yeah. So but in the end, they said, in fact, dinosaurs really haven't left. They did mention some other species like crocodiles and alligators. They said that snakes to a degree, boa constrictors, and they said birds are an extinct relative because we found the feathers on the first. Dinosaur that appeared to have wings, actually there's a perfect fossilization of the wingspan behind its arms. So that's what they're saying. Regardless, we'll probably really never know. The other problem I have isn't.
Well, maybe that's why when I was sitting down at the restaurant many, many years ago and Ferg wanted to get some gator bites and said, what do they taste like? Well, the waiter looked at him and said, like chicken.
Right, yeah.
Maybe there's a reason behind that.
Right. I was going to say that I have a problem with Paula Deen, but not nearly as much as her apologists who want to defend her and say, oh, she said the N-word 25 years ago. What they're after her for now, wasn't for saying that. It was for going to that damn wedding and being taped saying, hey, let's make them do this, the new black kids do the dance like the slaves used to do.
Well, or actually, she said, I wish I could do one of them. You know, they're so cute.
Right, I'm and just, there, you know, there was...
But, you know, the fact of the matter is, she turns out to be, and I use this phrase hesitantly, she turns out to be white trash because she used the N-word. If she'd been an upper crust bigot, she would have used darky or pickaninny.
My mom is a year younger than she is. I have never once, and I don't even once, heard my mom say the N-word in my entire life, regardless of situation. My grandfather, on the other hand, that's a different story. He was born in 1914. He had said it occasionally, and it wasn't right, but he came from that time period where, unfortunately, things were different. So I don't give her much room in this part about, hey, I'm from a different generation. No, you're not really. You're from the same generation my mother was. She saw the civil rights movement. She was actively in, probably in her 20s when it happened. So I think she can appreciate that. And then I saw something else where people are saying, well, now that they're taking away all Apollo's contracts, this and that, they fully expect Walmart to yank all the CDs off the shelves because of their obligatory racism towards white people.
Ain't the same thing.
That's my real problem in this situation. They're not even close to the same thing.
No, the one that drives me crazy is, well, them rappers, they use the N-word. How's come they can do it, but we can't?
Because they changed the word to take the power away from it. It isn't the same word.
Yeah, well, these clueless dipsticks are people who never, for instance, heard Lenny Bruce say, peace be upon him, by the way, who never heard Lenny Bruce say, I say we say it all the time till it means absolutely nothing.
Right. And that's kind of what these guys did. I mean, it's in their culture, and it's a whole different word to them than what people see it as. They can't see the replacement of one letter with another letter to take away its power and term embracing it more than what it wasn't. So I just can't get past people's blind stupidity horses, and they still can't see the racism going on around them. You take the Trayvon Martin case right now. You look at what that goddamn lawyer, the defense lawyer for Zimmerman, was doing to that younger woman who was Trayvon's friend. He's trying to make her look like a freaking idiot. And she's doing it to him because he's not afraid to talk the way she talks.
Yeah, that's a loser.
Right. And he's trying
But then
to
again, so too, that lawyer appears to be.
Right. So, I mean, it's a discussion, unfortunately, that will never go away, I don't think. We're never going to get past this. Hate's always going to be there. All you do is dig. It's just below the surface. But still, these people are mind-numbingly stupid most of the time. And by these people, I mean the people who are saying, well, now that they've taken away the contracts, let's pull the rap CDs off Walmart shelves. Like, Walmart's the only place that sells them because of the racism towards white people on those CDs.
Well, what I'm waiting to see is whether or not Wally World will continue selling her cutlery and home decor.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, no kidding. The best chef's knife you can buy in Wally World is a Paula Deen.
I've mentioned his name before, but I'll let you go because you almost have to go here. But there's a quotation of one of my favorite rappers, Tupac. He says in one of his songs, he's talking to Clinton at the time because he was in office at the time. He said, "We still haven't seen our 40 acres and a mule, fool." That's taken right from Lincoln's promise when they freed the slaves. It never happened for most of them. So that's part of it right there, too.
Indeed. Hey, thanks for reminding me to take a look at the clock. I'm having so much fun. Time's just flying by. Jeremy, have a good night.
You too.
All right, bye now.
Bye.
Buddy, me calling from onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Billy.
Hey, Billy, what's happening?
Well, real quickly, first things first, thanks for announcing the challenge. And I feel maybe Wednesday because you're right, nothing's going to get done, you know, after.
Well, the offices won't, people can't call on Thursday or Friday, the offices are closed.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, I'm going to start doing different challenges to help us with ACAC. I encourage anyone else to do that, too. you know, we could.
Yeah, and
you know,
you raise a good point. I want to hit this just real quick on the fly, Billy. It's tough because we have to continue the fundraising here just to keep all the plates spinning on the sticks in the air for the horn. If we were fully funded, it would be so nice just to begin every program and pitch that people give to the AID campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'm not kidding when I say that we go to Washington, D.C. and eat beans and eat rice. And there's nothing wrong with eating beans and rice. But, I mean, we really are running the effort on a shoestring. The rent for the HQ up there is exorbitant by just about anybody's standards. But by the same token, it's low rent for something there on Capitol Hill, and it's a far cry from what we would be spending if we were going up there and spending a month in a hotel.
Oof. Yeah. No. I understand the hotel thing. You know. Well, that's $59 a night. You know. Total that over 2 weeks. That'll get you. I'm not a math major, but that's you know, a lot of money, and that's in South Charleston. Any you know Red Roof Inn in D.C., you know that's going to be.
Oh, I've stayed in a Red Roof Inn over in Chinatown in D.C. and.
Oh yeah, I know where that is.
Yeah, and you know that was $175 a night for a Red Roof Inn.
Yeah. Oh man.
Hey, well, we got to get out of here, Billy. It's awful good to talk to you. I'm sorry you had to wait so long.
It's all right, man. Good conversations. I'm loving the show.
All right. Take care. Bye now.
Yep. Bye-bye.
And Billy's challenge is on the table. Remember, he needs 5 people to shoot an email to me to let me know that you have called Chris Van Hollen's office to ask him to get on and co-sponsor the ACAC. When those 5 confirmations have come in, Billy will then contribute $25 to the horn and $25 to the 8 campaign. That's pretty cool. It is time to get out of here. Thank you all for everything you've done to make this Moran Monday as special as it has been. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for taking care of fundraising and getting that out of the way. Now we got $150 to worry about tomorrow. So thank you. I'm sure we'll take care of that as well. Thanks for your contributions of your ideas, your conversation, the precious finite time you spend with us all. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Sparky and Lottie and Betsy in the chat room, our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and yes, ACACT.org, ACHEACT.ORG. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Better. Sorry for the delay there. I had to make an adjustment to my monitor. All better now. This is the horn. It is Titanic Tuesday on the horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. And you are welcome to go there. Join the conversation presently underway in the chat room. Use the listen live button there, or listen on your favorite streaming app, either via your PC or your streaming, your so-called smart device, your tablet, your smartphone, whatever. We like TuneIn Radio and Stitcher. That's it. Oh, yeah. Well, the podcast address is whiteroadsociety.org under this subdomain. And you can get the podcast at iTunes. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. Good news. We begin the evening having accomplished a significant portion of our fundraising. And we need raise only math on the fly, my bad. $85 for people, which is awesome. Just awesome. And thanks go out both, I like to make sure that we do get our, do put out the appropriate thanks to, those who helped keep this all on the air, the plates spinning on the sticks, as it were. My apologies. I'm a little bit addled. Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, there's some technical stuff that switch over and whatnot in between shows. And we had what happened there, for those of you who are listening to Dr. Bill, and why aren't all of you, we had a blue screen of death, a BSOD incident with the laptop that runs Skype. But thank you to Andrew, thank you, and thank you to Paul, both for getting us going even before the show went to air this evening. It is much appreciated, very much so. And so, you know, $85 is reachable, I hope. And I was reminded, or it occurred to me, you know, usually we try to raise $150 a night just to keep up with everything that we have to keep up with to keep all this going. But this is going to be a short week because there will be no show on Thursday. And I will try to be here on Friday. But that Thursday creates it's a short fall week. It just is. So thanks for y'all getting out in front of the fundraising, both of these evenings. And thanks, Jeremy, for kicking in, too. It's much appreciated. All right. Titanic Tuesday. You know how last night we talked about the Titanic genius involved in raiding the Medicaid funds here in West Virginia, because it turns out that, once again, the coal industry is not holding up its end of the bargain. Yeah. I got another one for you. This is a danger. And I tell you these West Virginia stories just because they help me feel a little bit saner. Now, we know what a controversy the American drone policy has created, right? Over at Crooks and Liars, ProPublica, writing today, this morning, boy's death in drone strike tests Obama's transparency pledge. Yeah, apparently we wiped out a 10-year-old boy in an attempt to get his elder brother, who was some sort of desperate type who hated America because we have home mortgages or something. I forget how it was, George Bush phrased it. But, yeah, we did. And that's unconscionable. So, lo and behold, yesterday, a lot of states had laws go into effect yesterday. For instance, in this state, it is now a probable cause primary offense for a cop to stop you if you are engaged in handling, basically, your cell phone while you're driving. I'm not going to mount a big complaint about that. However, another law went into effect here in West Virginia yesterday. And it's a real Lulu. A Jim Dandy. Yeah. Here in West Virginia, it is now a crime to fly a drone over someone's private property. Can we all say the magic word together? Nullification. Yeah, you know why this thing went through. Whatever subterfuge was engaged in, you know why this thing went through, right? Well, it went through because a few months back there was this giant hissy fit thrown. And, by the way, thank you. Thank you very much, Karen. Now, between you and Jeremy, we have only $60 to raise to get to the end of the evening. Wonderful. The reason this happened, this, you know, no drones in West Virginia, because a few months back, maybe a year or so ago, it was the American people were informed that, in fact, the EPA, or maybe the USDA, no, it's the EPA, the job-killing, over-regulating EPA, was a-flying some drones over polluters. And freedom-loving Americans didn't approve. So, and it's kind of weird because allegedly it's a slim majority, but there is a majority of Democrats in both the Senate and the House of Delegates of West Virginia, and we have an allegedly Democratic governor. I think we'd probably better put scare quotes around Democratic when we're talking.
It's the Rick Smith Show on.